Hey, nurses! This National Nurses Week 2025, it's time to celebrate you, the backbone of healthcare, with a vacation you truly deserve. Join Nurse.com for a luxurious group cruise aboard Virgin Voyages, sailing May 9th through May 14th. It's a celebration like never before, designed exclusively for nurses. Picture this. Tranquil ocean views, world-class amenities, and the chance to connect with your nursing community while leaving the stress of long shifts far behind. Plus, when you join us, you'll receive $200 in onboard credit per cabin to enjoy spa treatments, premium excursions, merchandise, and more. You spend every day caring for others. Now it's your turn. Let's trade scrubs for sandals and sail into National Nurses Week with joy, connection, and well-deserved relaxation. Register now to join the group trip at nurse.com/cruise. That's nurse.com/cruise. We can't wait to celebrate you. Hey, nurses. Welcome to the Nurse Dot Podcast, giving nurses validation, resources, and hope one episode at a time. Today on Nurse Dot Podcast.
Daily, sweep and mop the floors of your ward, dust the patient's furniture and windowsills. Maintain an even temperature in your ward by bringing in a scuttle of coal for the day's business. The nurse's notes are important in aiding your physician's work. Make your pens carefully, and you may whittle the nibs. Graduate nurses in good standing with the director of nurses will be given one evening off each week for courting purposes. Any nurse who smokes, uses liquor in any
or two form. Evenings a week if she regularly attends church,
gets her hair done at a beauty shop
each day, fill the kerosene lamps,
or frequents dance hall,
clean chimneys,
will give the director of nurses good reason to suspect her worth and trim wigs. Intentions and integrity.
Joining us today, America Farrell. America began her nursing career in 1975 as an LPN in the ICU while working towards her RN, which she earned in 1978. She dedicated 27 years to ICU nursing before going back to school for her MBA. From there, she transitioned into hospital administration, eventually spending nearly two decades as a hospital CEO. Together, we'll be discussing how nursing has evolved over the past 50 years.
I'm your host, Kara Lunsford, registered nurse and VP of Community at nurse.com.
Well, America, I'm so happy to have you here. We've talked several times, and in fact, the last time we talked, I was like, well, that could have been the podcast.
I remember.
Because we just, it was so organic. It was so easy. And I would just love for you to just introduce yourself to the audience, tell them who you are and how long you've been a nurse. And because we're going to be talking about nursing through the ages.
Right. Well, thank you so much, Kara. And I appreciate the invitation to be talking with you again today. And I did enjoy our last conversation. You're easy to talk to. And I'm very much looking forward, finally, to this day has arrived after a couple of little setbacks. So I'll start with my name is America Farrell. And my first name really is America. A lot of people ask me how I got my name. My father was very patriotic. He was an advisor to President Eisenhower. I was born in an election year. I was his last child, and I was born out of the country. So I think he got a little carried away with all that and went a little crazy. He was a little eccentric anyway, in a good way. But he actually wanted to name me Miss America, with Miss being my first name and America being my middle name. And luckily, my mother stepped in and drew a line, set a boundary, and said, we're not doing
that
to this child. So anyway, my name is America, but everybody's called me Missy. That's my family name is Missy. So we got the Miss and the America in there finally. But Anyway, I was born in 1955, so I am a product of the last century. So I'm glad you invited me on to do Nursing Through the Ages, because I do feel qualified at this point to do that.
I hope it doesn't come across as, I think you're old. That is not the case at all.
No.
You're just well-qualified.
Well-qualified, and I've got deep perspective on this.
Yes.
I graduated from high school in 1973, graduated from LPN school in 1975, and went straight to work. I wasn't sure at the time that I wanted to be a nurse. I was not one of those girls that grew up in my life playing nurse or anything like that. It was more of a practical decision. And in the culture I was raised, it was not uncommon for women to get a college education, but predominantly the education was either in liberal arts or in fine arts. And somewhere in the back of my head, you know, my plan was to grow up, marry a rich man, and live in a cottage with a white picket fence and have babies and, you know, be part of the bridge club and junior league and things like that. But I just
sounds lovely.
Yeah, right. But I just always had this little nagging thought in the back of my head that what if that doesn't work out? Maybe I ought to get something vocationally that I can support myself. So the three options that I saw that would were reasonable for me to attain at that point in my life was either being a teacher, being a secretary, or being a nurse. And I thought being a secretary sounded boring. Sorry to any secretaries out there. I've since learned that I was very wrong about that. I knew I did not have the patience to be a school teacher. So I thought by process of elimination, that just leaves nursing. So I went ahead and joined a vo-tech school. And I thought, well, I'll go get my LPN. Back then it was 18 months. And I thought, well, at least, you know, I have something to make a living while I figure out what I really want to do. But within 2 weeks into the program, I had already been down to the RN school in my community and talked to them about signing up because I instantly fell in love with nursing. And they were already full for that year, so I couldn't get in here. But long story short, I was able to clep out what I had done in LPN school and go in in the second year. And I went to a diploma program, which for any nurses listening, some of you may remember what a diploma program is. And it's a 3-year program.
I do.
For those of you who don't know, it's a 3-year program. Back then we didn't have associate's degree and we didn't have a bachelor's degree either. I mean, it was diploma or nothing. And basically you lived in a dorm on the campus of a hospital and you were the laborer of the hospital. And in return, you got a great education. And I will say a great education. And we had to be on the floor at 7 every morning with a smile on our face and our white uniform starched and our cap and our white hose and our white shoes. And we worked all day, every day, but you really learned a lot that way. Graduated from nursing school in 1978. And I had worked as an LVN in the intensive care unit, putting myself through RN school. And when I got out of RN school, I stayed in ICU because that was my love. That was my first love. It's been my only really love.
Isn't that amazing that I just want to make a note that you were an LVN in the intensive care unit, which is not something you hear about anymore.
Oh, you can't do it anymore.
You don't hear about LVNs actually in the acute care space that often.
No,
but I
not
think
anymore.
That maybe that's coming back a little bit more. But I just wanted to note that really quickly because I thought that that's a really interesting call out that's where
you
worked. Yeah,
and we could do everything that an RN could do except hang blood.
Wow.
So we could do everything an RN could do. So it was in the ICU. Now, I don't want to get...
Could you do assessments?
Yes.
Could you do assessments too?
Yes.
Oh, wow.
Yes.
Not just data collection.
No, we did everything in the ICU. Now, not to make this too complicated, but out on the floor back then, they had team nursing. So you had the RN doing the assessments, hanging of the blood, the complicated things, checking off orders. Your LVN, your LPN, whatever you call it, was the medication nurse. Mm-hmm. And then you also had a CNA. So every day you were a team of three, and you might have, you know, eight patients. And we'll talk about that again in just a little bit. I hope bring me back to that, because nowadays out on the floor, it's not uncommon for one nurse to have eight patients. Yes. And I do want to touch on that a little bit.
I'm sorry I interrupted you, but I was like, I don't want to skip past that, because I think that that's such an interesting thing that you were, you know, that you called out that you used to work as an LVN in an intensive care unit.
Yeah, and that's how I pretty much put myself through RN school. Anyway, I worked as an ICU nurse for 27-ish years. And when I was in my early 50s, and this, anybody listening, I want to tell you it's never too late. When I was 44, so I completed a master's degree, but I did an MBA, not an MSN. Got a little bit of heat from that, but I persisted anyway, and ended up going into hospital administration. And so you can be a nurse manager, director with a bachelor's degree. And I had to go back also and get my bachelor's degree, which I completed at age 40. And then at 42, I was back in school pursuing a master's degree, an MBA, finished with that around age 44-ish, something like that. Worked as a nursing director at various hospitals in an ICU, progressive care units. Often I had ICU, progressive care unit, and ER all under me. I also, you know, kind of did some other things which aren't relevant really to this conversation, but just know my whole background was ICU, some emergency room. And then I went to work for a company when I was about 50-ish to be an internal consultant with them. I traveled a lot, saw a lot of different hospitals, and I was their ICU consultant. And I'd go out to their hospitals and help identify where some problem areas were, you know, that kind of thing. And I came back and I kept going, you know, the hospital's really good. The nurses are really fantastic. But I don't know about the leadership. Anyway, long story short, I decided I wanted to be a hospital CEO. So at age 53, I hop out and get thrown into the pool, you know, my company. I'm always will be grateful that they gave me that opportunity. And I was a COO for about a year and a half, and then I got my own shop. So I've been a hospital CEO nonstop since 2009. Wow. And was CEO of probably four or five different hospitals. I would get moved around within my company. And then I wrapped up my career I retired about a year and a half ago, about 2 years ago. So I got about 50 years in of my career, and it's been a great journey. Started as an LPN, ended up as a hospital CEO. And a big shout out from me to any RN CEOs that are out there, because it's a long journey and a completely different skill set. But I will always say that nurses make the best CEOs, because we are all about the patients, and we can keep our hospitals focused on patient-centric care. So that's my journey.
I could not agree more. And this, everything that you just said is exactly why I wanted you to come and speak, you know, with us and with the audience. So, because you have a very unique perspective, because you have worked bedside for many, many years. You've worked management for many years.
Many years.
And you've also now, you're over on the administrative side as a CEO. And I think a lot of times what happens is that some of the people, some of the nurses that are at the bedside, there's this kind of, we kind of demonize the administrative, like they don't understand us.
Right.
So there's this huge disconnect between feeling like the CEO or the upper administration understands or truly understands the pain points of what the frontline staff is facing.
And doctors very much are like that as well. As it's, again, it's not just the nurses that
no.
demonize administration. It's the physicians. And, you know, as a CEO, I was on the receiving end of that a lot. But it also taught me a lot. And I, one of the main things that I learned when I very first started my very first shop, first day, I put up an 8x10 framed picture of my nursing graduation picture. So I'm like, you know, 55 years old at this point, and this is my picture of me when I was 22. And I got it right on my credenza, like you can't miss it. And I thought, well, this is either going to make me or break me. I'm going to see how this goes, you know. And also, in a few minutes, I know we'll talk about a little bit of gender bias.
Yeah.
And nurse-doctor
dynamics.
dynamics. And I thought, okay, this is either going to make me or break me. But without exception, every physician that walked in my office went, "You're a nurse? Oh, thank goodness. I can talk to you. I can talk to you now. And you'll get it."
That's wonderful. That's wonderful.
Yeah, it was really, really good. And so if they wanted to come in and yell at me about the nurses are not getting I's and O's on the chart fast enough, or radiology is having a problem. And I had been a COO, so I had also been well-versed in imaging, lab, pharmacy, all the other ancillaries, the therapies. I'd managed all of those as well, knew nothing about them when I started. And, you know, literally my first day as a COO, I walked down to imaging and the director had been there for like 25 years. And I just said, "Hey, Carlos, I'm your new boss. Need to let you know I know absolutely nothing about imaging and your department, how you run it, what's important to you. And you're going to need to teach me." And I think that's the attitude that made me successful, was not going in like I knew everything. It was the same thing in pharmacy. It was the same thing in lab. I mean, I didn't know anything about the nuts and bolts of how any of those departments worked. But anyway, that was good training for me. And then so when I got to be a CEO, I did have that broad knowledge of pretty much every department in the hospital. And I could say to anyone that came in my office, just tell me what your problem is, and I think we could fix this. So it was good training for me.
So I think that's also a nice shout out to say, hey, if you're thinking about going back to school, you don't have to go for your MSN. You don't have to go for your DNP. You know, you can go for an MBA and you can effectively move up into positions where you can feel like you can move the needle and be effective in changing healthcare systems. So
right. And even when I did that, that was back in 2000, 2001. And even then, when I was applying to a university where I did my MBA, and I won't call it out because I don't want to, you know, embarrass them. But when I was applying and interviewing, the question just kept coming up, "Why do you want an MBA? You're a nurse.
You're just a nurse, America. You're just a nurse."
Yeah.
We hate,
you're a nurse. It's like, you're a nurse.
Just what a nurse.
You know, what could you possibly understand about business? You're a nurse. You're just a nurse. And I just said, listen, I'm accountable every day for what goes on my floor. And no, nobody teaches you business in nursing school. Nobody teaches you really what an FTE is or how to stay within a budget. I mean, I didn't hear any of that. I grew up in the day, which was, I'm here to take care of patients. And you're here to worry about the money. Don't bother me with such nonsense. I'm just going to take care of patients. And I've lived through years and years of change, I'll just put it. And, you know, you kind of have to adapt with the times. And so that's why I wanted to do an MBA, just because I could get a little bit more business knowledge. That was just for me, because I knew I wanted to go into administration. And you can do three things as a nurse. You can either go the education pathway and be an educator. You can go the clinical pathway, be like nurse practitioner or clinical nurse specialist, any of that. Or you can go the administrative pathway. And I already knew I wanted to go to the administrative pathway. So that's more why I did that. And we didn't even have, we may have had one or two MHA programs, but they were very rare when I did my MBA. And so that was the closest thing. If I had it to do it again, I'd probably do an MHA.
Yeah, that makes sense. Like that, I think that's another good alternative, that if you don't want to do an MBA, like the MHA is probably that's a good pathway.
Right. And I even have friends, though, now that have an MHA and have gone back to get an MBA on top of that, just because they wanted that little bit more depth of knowledge. And I was blessed to go to a really good, really good MBA program. And I'm glad for that. The director of the program had actually been the dean of Harvard MBA program and had left to kind of found this one. And so brought a wealth of knowledge and experience with her. And she wasn't really sure about me. Told me I was kind of there. She's going to watch me, you know, and see how I did.
That's so interesting. I mean, I think that brings up a really good point of you were talking about gender bias. And I think if we go way back, you know, if we go back 50 years or even further, you know, I had interviewed Dr. Ann Burgess. Are you familiar?
Yes. You turned me on to her. And yes. I've done a lot of study and research and watching, and she's amazing.
She's so cool. I was totally fangirling over that.
Yes.
So she talks about a little bit of what it was like, and but very briefly. So for you, when you first went into, I know we talked a little bit about how women had a couple of like typical options for them, like you said, secretary, teacher, nurse, and that tended, and if they were going back to school, it was something in the arts, liberal arts or
fine arts,
homemaking, stuff like that. But even though you did choose, so you did choose nursing, but it was still, I mean, I would say it was still very oppressive.
Okay, so it was. Now, I'm going to, if you'll indulge me for a moment.
Yeah.
This may take maybe 3 minutes.
You I'm going to take you. As much as you want.
I'm going to take you back to 1887 for just a moment.
Okay.
And I'm going to give you a perspective. And I did the math this morning before I got on the podcast. And if I go 2024 minus 1887, that's 137 years. If you divide that by two, that's 68 years. So I'm 68 years old right now. Okay. So that's my lifetime and just one other lifetime. So I went not that far back, to be honest. That's like two lifetimes ago. But let me tell you what life looked like for a nurse in 1887. And you may have seen this, but for your listeners out there that haven't, this is called an 1887 nursing job description. Okay?
I can't wait. I'm so excited.
In addition to caring for your 50 patients, each bedside nurse will follow these regulations, and there's 9 of them. Number 1, daily sweep and mop the floors of your ward, dust the patient's furniture and windowsills. 2, Maintain an even temperature in your ward by bringing in a scuttle of coal for the day's business. 3. Light is important to observe the patient's condition. Therefore, each day fill the kerosene lamps, clean chimneys, and trim wicks. 4. The nurse's notes are important in aiding your physician's work. Make your pens carefully. And you may whittle the nibs to your individual taste. So I'm not sure if they meant pens or pencils, but either way, you had to make them. But you could whittle the knobs to your individual taste. That's important.
Were they actually using ink? Back then, I think it was. Dipped in ink, right?
Yes. 5. Each nurse on day duty will report every day at 7 a.m. That hasn't changed. And leave at 8 p.m. We're kind of back to that now. Except on the Sabbath, on which day she will be off from noon to 2 p.m. 6. Graduate nurses in good standing with the director of nurses will be given an evening off, one evening off each week for courting purposes, or 2 evenings a week if she regularly attends church. 7. I know, isn't this hard to imagine nowadays?
I know. So I guess this is going to inform a lot of our conversation.
Okay, 7. Each nurse should lay aside from each payday a goodly sum of her earnings for her benefits during her declining years, so that she will not become a burden to others. For example, if you earn $30 a month, you should set aside $15. Now, that's not a goodly sum. That's half of your paycheck.
Yes.
Yeah, okay. 8, any nurse who smokes, uses liquor in any form, gets her hair done at a beauty shop, or frequents dance halls will give the director of nurses good reason to suspect her worth, intentions, and integrity.
Wow.
9, the nurse who performs her labors and serves her patients and doctors faithfully and without fault for a period of 5 years will be given an increase by the hospital administration of 5 cents a day. Now, I did look up in preparation for this how much 5 cents a day is, you know, in our modern day money, and it would be $1.66. So every nurse now, if they perform faithfully for 5 years, can get $1.60 a day, or if you do the math, $49.80, almost $50 a month. But that's after 5 years, and then you get $50 a month. So
wow.
Now let's fast forward a little bit to 1970 or so.
I'm so curious, by the way, and I'm going to look this up. And I encourage our listeners to look this up. I want to know what the job description is for a doctor back in 18, like just to see how much more well respected they are in that. It would be so interesting to see the difference.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
We should all do that.
We should all do that.
Mental health matters. Become a master's prepared psychiatric mental health nurse practitioner at Nightingale College. If you are an RN with a bachelor's degree in nursing, you can take the next step in a rewarding career move where you'll develop advanced knowledge and skills in assessment, intervention, and management within the construct of the psychiatric mental health patient-provider relationship and patient-centered care across the lifespan. This CCNE accredited program is now taking applications for the fall 2025 semester. For more information, please visit nightingale.edu or call 801-689-2160. because mental health matters.
So in 1970, I went to boarding. I was in boarding school. I went to boarding school for high school, and I was in an all-girls boarding school in the Deep South. And just to let you know that urban legend, I don't know if any of your listeners out there will remember a TV show called Gunsmoke. And there used to be a character on there named Miss Kitty. And she was the brothel owner, but beloved by everyone. She was the mainstay of the whole town. And you had, you know, the sheriff. And it was a great show, Gunsmoke. But Miss Kitty was actually went to my same boarding school when she was a teenager. But she was expelled for filing her fingernails in public. So, yes, wow. We've come a long way from 1887, but even fast forward almost 100 years, there still was a lot of preconceptions about how a lady should conduct herself. And nurses were held to an even higher standard than regular ladies, because we were angels of mercy and we were the doctor's handmaidens and we were all this and all that. And so, you know, 1973 comes around. I graduate from high school by 1975. And, you know, from 73 to 75, I'm a student in my LPN program. From 75 to 78, I'm a student in my RN program. And, you know, when we were the nurses, when the doctor arrived on the floor, the nurses had to get up out of our seat at the nurses' station, give him our chair, and bring him his coffee, cigarette, and ashtray. And then when he went to go rounding on the patients, we followed behind with our chart, with all the patient charts. We carried them. We were his caddy. We carried them, and we had to hand them to him, and then he would write in them and then give them back to us. So we had this great big, you know, stack of charts we're carrying down the hall. I just still don't know why then, you know, they didn't have little carts, but I guess that was another story. And at that time, around 1973 to 1975, the world was just starting to let nurses take blood pressures, or at least where I was, because they felt like that was too highly technical a task for nurses. You know, to put the cuff on, get it right, use the stethoscope, listen to the blood pressure. That was a doctor's job.
For those of you who can't see me, I'm just sitting in horror. I just the whole time, it's my face is just contorted in just disbelief, and it's just so hard to believe that we were thought so little of.
Well, and you know, God forbid that you would ever question a doctor writing an order. This is part of the reason I wanted to go into the ICU, was because they let you do a little more in the ICU. The doctors had a little bit more respect for you in the ICU. And it was just, life was a little better in the ICU or specialty areas, ER, operating room, cath lab. Not that cath labs were all that popular yet back then, but specialty areas, you got more leeway. And, you got to do cooler stuff.
I'm just so curious. Like, did you feel like a lot of nurses, like sometimes like I read things about the past or I hear things about the past, and I wonder if the nurses felt as oppressed as when we look back on it, like if in the moment they were like, this is wrong.
I'll give you my opinion, and not all of your listeners would agree with me, but I don't think so. I think we were programmed to believe what we believe. I think we were conditioned, and we were, I don't want to be cynical and say we were sold the fairy tale, but I'm just for this purposes of this, you know, we were sold the fairy tale that we were angels of mercy. You know, come on, we're all dressed in white every day. We're sitting at the patient's bedside. You know, part of our evening care that we did every night included a back rub, and we sit and we listen to them, and it was very holistic, and we really were like angels to the sick and the dying. And I think part of the what just came along with it was that, yeah, we were often disrespected by physicians. But that was just, you know,
that was part of it.
That was just part of it.
But did you feel like you actually had more, like you were more satisfied with the work that you were doing? Because I do think that some of what's missing today is actually some of what you just said, the sitting at the bedside, the holding space, the listening, the showing up, being able to be an ear to them. We miss that now. Like some of that's actually missing.
Oh, that's a lot of that is missing. And, you know, to my point, when we did team nurses, we may have 12 patients or maybe even 14, maybe 12, 13, 14, depending on where you work. But you're a team, you know, you're team nursing. And there's an old Indian proverb that says, one man cannot build a house alone, but two men working together can build a village.
Oh, that's cool.
Because of synergy. So every day you go in, you've got your team. And, you know, it would be fun to have competitions with the other teams. And, you know, we loved it. It was, you have a friend. And then when we went to primary nursing, it became you, yourself, and you. And they started with, okay, you've got four patients. But at the time, they also took the unit clerks away. So you were putting in your own orders. You were doing everything, including often cleaning the rooms and emptying the trash for the patients. And yeah, housekeeping comes around once a day. But if you're in an ICU, you fill up that trash can three or four times during your shift. I mean, so you're doing everything. Now, if you're in an ICU, though, to my point, you usually got, back then we had two patients. So I always felt like I could just take really, really good care of the two patients. Mm-hmm. But I'm talking about the floor nurses that originally were told that they would take four patients a day. Then it creeped up to five. Then it and they kind of started to do away with the CNAs. So maybe you'd have one CNA for your whole unit for the day.
Yep.
Well, good luck trying to get somebody to help you change a bed, get a patient up, do a bath, walk somebody after surgery. It's like, no, it's you.
Yeah.
We didn't have that in team nursing, and I'm just a huge proponent of team nursing. And I know some places are easing back into that, and I say congratulations to them.
What about where you work? Has that been kind of, are you bringing that back a little bit more?
Well,
or trying
I've been retired for a couple of years, so I can't really speak to what they're doing currently, but there was talk of that, you know, because how do we bring some synergy? Because to me, the problem is you have all these nurses doing primary nursing, but each man is an island. It's like every man for himself. And it's very, very, very difficult. And the nurses are heroes. They're just heroes. I don't know how they do what they do, especially during COVID. I could cry just even talking about the sacrifices that nurses have made. But anyway, we'll get back on topic. But that's just sort of how I've seen the evolution.
Slow boiled. It's like people got slow boiled, you know, you just kind of, the heat just kind of slowly creeps up and, you know, they say, I don't think this is actually true at all, but they're like, oh, if you, you know, put a frog in water and you just kind of slow boil them, they won't jump out. But if you throw them right into a boiling pot, they'll like jump right out of the water. I think it's a good visual because I think that happens a lot is that
there is a lot of truth to that. I still remember when nurses petitioned in most places and went from wearing whites to wearing scrubs. And at first,
when was that?
In my lifetime, I mean, I was still working in the ICU and I went in every day in my white dress and my white hose and my white shoes and my white cap. And I did that for years and years and years. And then we transitioned to scrubs. And I was alternately horrified. But at the same time, I went, well, this makes perfect sense. And it's really about time. Because, you know, I'm trying to get blood out of my white dresses and things worse than blood, you know, and it was a huge laundry challenge. And I thought, well, this makes sense. I wonder why we haven't done it. But culturally, socially, psychologically, moving from whites into scrubs.
And dresses into pants. I mean, because you went from a dress to pants. And that was also something that for a while was not acceptable.
Well, we could wear white pantsuits.
Oh, you could.
We could wear white pantsuits. So in all fairness, I did have white pantsuits. But, you know, I was about half and half. I still wore my dresses a good bit. But going into scrubs just made me feel like we had become a technician or something. I don't know. Only people in the operating room wore scrubs. It just seemed wrong, you know? Yeah. But it took me about 5 seconds to adapt. And I was, you know, happy.
I had two teachers, by the way. I had two teachers during my, because I went to county. We talked about this. I went to county nursing school. And they started as a diploma program. And I'll joke and say that the Block sisters, who were twins, Carol, and her middle name was Lynn, and then Carolyn Block.
Oh, no.
Yes. And they both wore the white dresses, and they would even wear the hats. Yes.
Yeah. I wore my hat a while, even with my scrubs, until... You know, they said we didn't have to anymore. And like nobody was doing that anymore. So a lot of changes, you know, that we've gone through. I remember when DRGs came out. And that was when we first had to start being a little bit accountable for the money we spent. And I remember being so offended when I became a nurse manager. This was after my MBA, but we used to go in every month, and they still do this. Nurse managers need to go in. You have to meet with the CFO or his designee, his or her designee. And you have what's called an MOR, and it's your monthly operational review. And they sit down, and they look at your productivity and your labor cost and your supply cost and all of these things. And I had never been trained in any of that. So, we used to call it our monthly hemorrhoidectomy all between us and all the managers, you know. And I remember being so offended when somebody told me to open a package. If I opened a package of 4x4s and I only used half of them, I had to seal it back up and use the other half later. But the problem was that the CFOs, they don't know, like, these are sterile. You can't just reuse them. And I remember one of my biggest fights was over 4x4s. Once you open that package, it's not sterile. You cannot pack wounds with a leftover 4x4s that have been opened yesterday. You know, things like that, that just took years of
fighting.
You're not...
It's fighting. It's tiring, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's tiring to fight.
And that's what nurses go through. And, you know, and you've got a manager that'll come back from the MOR and they have their next staff meeting. They go, okay, everybody, you've got to reuse your 4x4s. And then, you know, all the nurses get mad. But to my credit, I was never that nurse manager. I said, that's what they told me in my MOR, but I'm coming back now to tell you, do not do that. You do not have to do that. You do what's best for your patient.
Yep.
Now, where you can save money, please save money.
Yeah. And that's fair.
But nothing that will compromise patient safety.
Stay tuned for part 2 of this very special episode. If you're a nurse or nursing student that enjoyed this episode, visit us at nurse.com/community,
where you can find the Nurse Dot discussion group, a place where we dissect each episode in detail and delve deeper into today's topics. Nurse Dot is a Nurse.com original podcast series. Production, music, and sound editing by Dawn Lunsford. Production coordination by Rhea Wade. Additional editing by John Wells. Thank you to all the listeners for tuning in to the Nurse Dot podcast. Until next time, keep spreading the love and the care.